Hi everyone, and welcome to this week's episode of Australian True Crime. Before we begin this week's episode, we would like to share a couple of things with you. First of all, we have been enjoying another True Crime podcast all the way from the Northern Hemisphere. Here's Christy from Canadian True Crime to tell you more.
Canada may be known as the friendliest country in the world, but make no mistake, it has some of the most shocking criminal cases too. My name is Christy, and I host Canadian True Crime. I'm Australian, but I've been living in Canada for many years. Canadian True Crime takes a deep dive into some of Canada's most well-known cases, like the Ken and Barbie killers, Robert Picton the pig farmer, and many smaller cases you probably haven't heard of, but are just as fascinating. If you're looking for the facts of the case told in a narrative storytelling format with ambient music, you can find me on your favourite podcast app or social media, just by searching for Canadian True Crime.
Several weeks ago, we were contacted by a listener, Alicia, who wished to share her own true crime story with the show. When she was 7 years old, Alicia was raped, and her case went unsolved for nearly 30 years. She has since struggled with various mental health issues as a result, as well as substance abuse and addiction, and though the road has been difficult for her, recent advancements in DNA technology and the availability of such technology saw her attacker convicted in 2016. She joins us this week to discuss the crime, the recent conviction, and how it has, and still does, affect her life looking into the future. A content warning for listeners also, this episode will contain discussion and description of child sexual assault and rape. Please listen at your own discretion.
I need to know how we have met Alicia. I'm yes. very pleased to meet you, Alicia, but I don't know how we have all come to be in this room together.
Well, Alicia and I have been talking for a number of weeks via email. Alicia actually contacted us, very keen to come and tell her story, and it's quite a story. It's her personal experience. And Alicia, as a child, was raped. So it's going to be a very difficult discussion to have.
Okay.
And Alicia's waiving her right to anonymity. Now, Alicia's going to tell us about what happened. Well, you know, the offence that took place, and then years later, this was a cold case.
Oh, wow.
This was absolutely cold.
Yeah, for 27 years.
And Alicia's bravery, she pushed to have this reopened, and she'll tell us what happened after that. But we've been talking for a number of weeks, and you were just really want to get your story out to give some hope to other victims or some courage to other victims.
Yeah, I think that's what it is. I feel like court and everything has gone on, and I feel like it's just there's been nothing. And I'm like, no, I feel like I could actually do more because I'm quite okay, if that makes sense. Like I feel like I'm quite normal, if there is such a thing. But, yeah, I just want to do something more. And the reason that I contacted the police and had my case revisited was I was sitting around at a friend's house speaking to one of her friends. We were having a few drinks and she was going through something similar. She had been attacked when she was about 15 and she was going through the court process, you know, later in life or later, you know, after the fact to have it open. I thought, well, hang on, if she can do it, why can't I? Why can't I contact the police and ask for my case to be revisited? So I guess, yeah, if it gives the courage to somebody else, and I'm not saying that everyone's going to have the same outcome that I have, but if it just gave somebody the courage to go, hey, I can do that, I can pick up the phone, then it's worth it.
I remember during the Royal Commission into the, what's the official title? It's so long-winded, into the conduct of institutions to sexual abuse of children. I think that was the entire name, it came out that I think the average length of time it took people to disclose sexual abuse from childhood was 33 years.
That's, I'm 36, so.
So that's roughly.
That's a long time to hide something.
And I met a lot of men from Ballarat who were in that situation, who had been sexually assaulted by clergy in Ballarat during that horrible period of time when there were a number of pedophiles working there. And, yes, it had taken them roughly that period of time to disclose.
Well, mine was actually a little bit different because mine was disclosed when it happened. So the night that it happened, the house was full of police. And
wow.
Yeah, so, and it was in the media back in 1989. my dad was on the news. I remember seeing my dad on the news. There was like two stations that blacked his face out, but one of them didn't. And I remember thinking, how silly is this? Because you could, I'm not sure which channel it was, but it was between, you know, 10, 7 and 9. And I was like, oh, you know, 10 and 7 have blacked his face out. Why didn't 9?
I always used to notice that as a kid about various stories. Yeah, and I was like, you think to yourself, well, I just saw that bloke on Channel 7. Why is Channel 2 not showing?
Yeah, he's there. And it was like full blackout face.
Your
like
dad
it was
one of them.
Yeah.
So, well, I hate to ask this question, but can you tell us what happened?
Yeah. So, well, as I said, I was 7 years old and I was walking home from school. We lived quite close to the school, but I had to walk. I had to cross quite a few main roads, and we also lived next to a hospital or opposite a hospital. So I used to cut through the car park of the hospital to get to this corner. Then I'd walk up, and to cross the main road, there was three crossing ladies. So I'd cross with the three crossing ladies, pass a milk bar, and then walk down another street to get to school. So it was a bit of a walk.
What year was this, sorry?
1989.
Okay. Right.
So my sister had just started year seven, so not obviously that year, so she was in year seven. So it was my first year of walking to school by myself. And, you know, there was no fear back then. Yep. There was no, we just did that. I mean, we, on the weekends and things, we were all out on our bikes. Yeah, we were never true. Inside the house, same. You know, there was never an adult around.
Yeah.
So, yeah, walking to school was fine. And so I was walking home from school this day, and as I came up to the milk bar, there was two guys standing near a tree, and I vividly remember one was leaning up against the tree and the other one sort of had his arm up and was talking to him. I just didn't think much of them, just a couple of guys, and I did my walk across where the crossing ladies were. And there's also another part where you could actually go across, and you know, as young kids it was jaywalking, like you could cut across, you didn't have to go where the traffic lights were. And you know, as kids, we never did that. But I noticed that one of the guys was actually doing that, and it was a shortcut to get to the hospital. So I noticed him doing that, but again, didn't think anything of it. Walked up, and as I got up to the corner right where the hospital was, where I was getting close, where I'd cut through the car park, he started following me. He was sitting on a brick fence, and I passed him, and he started following me. And then he got a little bit closer, and he said, oh, excuse me, I was just wondering if I could ask you some questions about your brother. And he said, I work for the council. And he goes, you know, I've seen you guys around. I know your brother's got a blue racer push bike. You've got your red one.
Is that all true?
Yeah, that was true. Yeah, okay. Because we did. As I said, we were out riding all the time. And, yeah, I had this red bike and you know, he'd seen us. He said, I was wondering if you can come to my office and I can ask a few questions. And I knew, like, it's funny because I look back now and I think, why did you go? Like, I knew that he didn't work for the council, but I just went, okay, and he grabbed my arm and he started leading me.
Can I just...
No,
it's okay.
I'll just go on so much here.
No, I don't want to interrupt your flow.
Yeah.
But I just do want to say, because just not for one single second do I want you to say, why did I do that?
Yeah.
I don't, I just, you know, I just want
to
make sure.
It's hard not to. Yeah. Like to think, oh, you know.
You know why you did? Because probably you're a really good little girl.
Yeah.
And an adult asked you to do something. And I don't know about you, but at that age I was very obedient and very
– yes.
I was raised to do what I was told to do by adults.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And adults, we – like my next door neighbour was Mrs. or Auntie.
Same.
You never called adults by their first
name. So as much as I was told stranger danger, and this is a well-proven fact now, isn't it? That as much as we were taught stranger danger – at the same time, our parents taught us respect for adults.
Yeah. Be polite.
Yes.
That's right. Yeah. So, yeah, I guess it wouldn't have been in me to scream and say, there's no way I'm coming with you.
I would have done the same
thing.
Because,
you just
he knew information about you.
Exactly. And my brother, I guess you'd say he has learning disabilities. He's a little bit of a slow learner. And he actually went to a different school to us. So he went to a school in Hawthorne.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I guess in a way it wasn't actually that unusual that somebody might want to ask questions about my brother.
Okay.
And so, yeah, so I went off with him. And I can't really remember much of the conversation, but we passed the hospital. And I sort of said to him, I'm not supposed to go this way. And it is in my statement too that I did say to him, I can't remember this, but I did say to him, like, I don't know you and I'm not allowed to go with strangers.
Okay.
And he was like, you know, it's okay, I'm not a stranger, I work for the council. So he did persuade me to go. And then, so we went up around the road, up around a corner, And there was, as kids growing up, we called the haunted house.
Yeah, we all had one of those in the neighbourhood, didn't we?
Yeah. And this one was like the haunted house of haunted houses. It had massive big pine trees at the front. They had a pool in the backyard because, you know, sometimes we'd sneak up the driveway and the pool was green and murky and there were little dogs in the house that would bark at the windows. And but you never, like, we never, ever saw anybody there, never. But there were people that lived there.
Oh.
And anyway, he started leading me up their driveway. And I said to him, I'm like, why are you taking me up here? Now, on the other side of the fence to the haunted house, it backed onto a kindergarten, or there was a big pine plantation, which then backed onto the kindergarten. And that was actually the kindergarten that I went to as a child. And he was taking me into that pine plantation. He said, my office is out here. Now, again, I knew there was no office out there because when I went to kindergarten there, so I was only in grade two, so it was only a few years since I'd been at kindergarten, we used to have Easter egg hunts in the kindergarten, and they would let us go out into the pine plantation, which was fenced off with a cyclone fence. But for the Easter egg hunts, we'd go out in there. So I knew that there was nothing in there, but he led us. And as I was walking up, I actually saw, I'm going to get a lump in my throat now, I saw the elderly gentleman that lived in the house raking up leaves in his driveway. And he sort of looked at us, and as he looked at us, my attacker, are we going with names?
It's up to you, Bob.
Yeah, so my attacker, Sterling Bauer, made me jump the fence, which was, you know, those old wooden style fences that has the three railings, just a normal fence. And so I got up to the top and then I couldn't get down, and he helped me down off the fence. And then he just said, come on, let's go to my office. And walking through there, there's so many parts of this story that I shouldn't actually laugh at, but as I was saying to Emily outside, I've almost disassociated myself with that 7-year-old girl.
Yeah.
So when I get upset about things, or when I laugh, and I guess the laughing thing's laughing at myself and the innocence, but yeah, I've very much so disassociated myself. So when I get upset for that girl, not for me.
Yeah.
If that, it's, yeah, it's a little bit strange. I don't know if you understand that, but it just,
it seems pretty normal to me.
So, yeah, he told me that he needed to go to the toilet, and I can remember being so embarrassed that, oh, my God, a man was going to be going to the toilet near me, and, yeah, he told me to turn around, and so I turned around while he went to the toilet behind a tree. And then, yeah, he just took me to an area where I don't know whether he had sussed the area out or what, and then he told me to lay down on the ground, and that's when he did what he did. I have no idea. Like, the only reason I know exactly what he did to me was when I read my statement 27 years after the fact, because I blocked it out of my memory. I have visions and I have flashbacks of, I could see his thighs, his naked thighs.
Sweetheart.
And I have memories of some things, but then there's a lot of, memories that, as I said, it wasn't until I read the statement that I actually realised how sick and disgusting he was.
Why did you have to read the statement for the court? Oh, I see. Okay.
Yes.
How was the process leading up to that? How did you have counselling to help you get ready to read the statement?
Oh, God, no. Like, it was the police officers, two detectives. One of them was the detective that worked for the cold case and missing persons unit. The other detective was the first detective from the Croydon CIU department that took me seriously. And when she heard on my voice that I wanted my case looked into, she was the first police officer that took me seriously, and I had spoken to maybe 7 or 8.
Did she know that you didn't remember any of the details?
No, I don't think they actually realised. Yeah, and so it was like, okay, we need you to read over your statement. And I just sat there at my kitchen table with my youngest daughter asleep in a cot in the next room and my eldest daughter in the lounge room watching Finding Nemo.
any other adults with you there?
No one. Just me and the two detectives.
Okay, the detectives were
with you. The detectives, they sat with me whilst I read it. So
what's your memory of that, of the moment, of the time after that? I mean,
of after the attack?
After reading that document.
It was hard. But again, it's hard because I feel so sorry for that poor little 7-year-old girl.
Yeah.
Not for me.
Yeah, okay.
And having two little girls myself, one of whom is now 7, that was more what I was concerned about. Not for me. I don't, as I said, it's really funny. I don't want to say I feel sorry, because I don't think that people should feel sorry for me.
Why not?
Because it's, I don't
is
know.
Is it like a more like of a you've got compassion for that little girl when she was, you know.
Yeah, gosh. Because it's almost, as I said, because I've disassociated myself, I feel so sorry for that little girl because I know what she's been through.
Yes, of course. No, of course.
Even though she actually is me, it's really, I guess it's just the coping.
Did the reading of the document bring back memories?
Yeah, but you know what? The reading of the statement, probably the best and the greatest thing that I got out of it was after all these years, what I can remember was exactly what was in the statement. And so for all these years I've wondered, is what I have remembered actually what happened, or is it what I've been told by somebody else? Yeah. And there was I won't go into too much detail about this, but there was actually something that I had been told was what happened, but that was not what I remembered. So when I read the statement, I actually realised that what I'd been told was to protect somebody else.
Oh.
Yeah, so there was things that I have lived with that I've been going, but I don't remember it like that.
So are you saying that it wasn't actually as bad as you remembered, or
no, it was just better because I could almost like say that I what I remembered was true.
Okay.
Like I was right.
Oh, yeah. I see.
Like I was correct. Yes. It almost like cemented the fact that you got it right, and what I remembered was what I remembered.
Because at the time, your sexual assault happened. It was in the papers, as you said.
Yeah, yeah.
And it got a bit of coverage and it was investigated.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And that was like a process all in itself.
What's the first thing you remember after the assault?
So the first thing after the assault was I remember him saying, he said to me when he was leaving, he said, "Do not move, and if you tell anyone, I will kill you."
Oh.
And I had told him where I lived. Like as we were walking, I was like, "Oh, I live at blah blah blah."
Yeah.
So he knew where I lived, but I don't know. I don't know whether I just didn't care or what. Now I grabbed my backpack. I got up and I pulled my pants up.
Mm-hmm.
I grabbed my backpack and I ran for the gate, which led out into the kinder. It was a 6-foot cyclone fence, and I was not the fittest of kids, but I scaled that fence like you would not believe. And jumped to the other side, and I ran, and I counted it the other night. It's like 8 houses to my house from the kinder.
Wow.
And I ran screaming the whole way. And it's funny because he said, "Don't tell anyone." Well, everyone knew.
Thank God for you.
Yeah.
Thank God you did.
Yeah. Yeah, like I'm glad that I told. Like,
of course,
you know,
so many kids don't. I mean,
that's right.
I often think that to myself. How do I explain to my kids that no matter what anyone says to you or threatens you with to say, don't tell your mum.
Yeah, I'll give you lollies. Yeah, I'll give you
or I'll hurt her or I'll hurt you.
Yeah,
don't ever believe that. You have to tell me everything. Mm. I always think, how do I get that through to them? So thank God
scared you'll get get in trouble for telling
and I'll get into trouble for going off with a stranger or I guess that wasn't just not even a thought that I had.
God.
And now we had a gravel driveway, and the whole drive here today I've been speaking to my sister, so she heard me. She said, because I was a little bit late home from school, she was walking to the back door to sort of go out the back door. And she said, like, her first memory of that day is hearing me running down the driveway on the gravel. And she said, I was screaming, "I've been attacked, I've been attacked, I've been attacked," as I was running down our driveway. And she said, I ran up. We had 10 back stairs. Get a bit teary here. I ran up the back stairs and I was in a purple tracksuit. Our school didn't have, like, a compulsory school uniform. I did have a proper school bag, which I'll mention later. But, I was in my purple tracksuit, And Mum came from the kitchen to the back door and I was screaming, I've been attacked. And my sister said that she just pulled my pants down and she said pine needles just went everywhere.
Oh, my God.
And she said, Mum, that was when my mum just panicked. So I can't remember any of this. So this is only going off what my sister's told me. And we talk about this, you know, it's never been a thing that we didn't talk about. So it's been quite open, especially the last couple of years. Yeah, so she said that Mum rang either the police, but she definitely rang the neighbourhood watch lady of our area. And my sister said, because my sister was 13, she said that she couldn't understand why Mum was ringing the neighbourhood watch lady. She was thinking, why was Mum ringing her? But anyway, and then Mum grabbed her car keys and took off in the car.
And left you girls at home?
Yeah.
She went looking for him?
Yeah.
Yeah.
She wanted to find him. Yeah. So on one hand,
mother's instinct,
yeah, find him, run him over, run him over again and keep going.
Yeah.
Yeah. Again, we don't know how long. My sister, she said she was so traumatised.
Yeah.
13 years old, she's got my sister there going, I don't know what to do. She said Mum came back and then the next thing, the house was just full. My sister said on the way here, she said it felt like there was 10,000 people in our house. Mm. She said, and she said all she could think about was everybody in Mum's nice lounge room.
The good lounge room. The family room and then there's the
and
room.
And all the police were in there sitting on Mum's good lounge suite with their shoes on. That's all she could think was, you know. And I know, like, I can remember being a bit silly and almost mucking about and, you know, like it was, that just shows the... like the innocence of it and the not really...
and
like
the brain's ability happened, to kind of protect you maybe.
Yeah.
Just, you know.
My sister said she didn't see me at all that night. I can remember when the police first got there. So then my next memory when, like, so my sister's memory was all the police there. My next memory was in the toilet. Mum's, you know, just a single toilet room. And my memory was the police officers pulling my pants down and collecting all the pine needles. And even that was another thing that my sister said, that Mum said when she was running out the door with the car keys, she said, don't touch anything. Mm-hmm. Like, don't touch anything on me.
Yeah.
Don't touch any of the stuff that had already fallen out of my knickers. Yeah. She said, yeah, don't touch a thing. So that was my next memory was, yeah, being in the bathroom and having a female police officer, yeah, take my pants down. And yeah. I guess then they probably collected all my clothes.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah.
Well, they did because
at home? This all happened at home.
Yeah, this was in the.
They didn't take you to a hospital.
That's my next memory was a hospital, and so we lived over the road from the hospital. Yeah, like it saved us many times from injuries.
Yeah,
Mum would just pick us up and run us over to the hospital. In fact, emergency had a deal with us that instead of us having to wait 8 hours, they'd go, "Oh no, we'll just call you when you're ready. You can wait at home. We'll just call you when it's your turn."
And so that
we were pretty accident prone.
That gathering of the evidence, so to speak. I mean, as you'll explain down the track, that was
very crucial. So crucial.
So what happens then? It's investigated, and there's just no arrests.
Yep. So there was no arrest. I did a sketch, and I've been told that there was two sketches. I only remember doing the one. I felt like I lived with the police for 3 months. Like, I can remember going to Target because I had to go and pick out his clothes and then we had to go and get my clothes because there was also one of those neighbourhood watch, you know, buses set up with, you know,
with the mannequins.
Yep. There was a Crime Stoppers reenactment, yes, done, which it's really, really funny, but the girl who played me in the reenactment, she actually ended up becoming a detective and she worked on my case.
Wow.
I met her in court and she was like, I already know you. And I was like, what? And she goes, when I first started doing this case, she goes, I know this. She's like, I know this case. The purple tracksuit. And her mum actually worked for Crime Stoppers. And so she did a few of the reenactment videos. And, yeah, they went back and sure enough it was her in the reenactment video.
So this was on TV. Yeah. It was on the news. It was in the Sun.
What's your memory of, like, being back at school? So obviously everybody knew.
Yep. Everybody knew. Now, there was only one person the next day, so the day after the attack, there was one mum that showed up at our house with a meal that she had cooked, and that was it.
Oh.
Nobody else. Everybody would sort of turn their backs. when you'd walk down the street. And because you'd walk down, you know, our local group of shops and the sketch was plastered everywhere. And so you'd walk down there and people would almost sort of turn away.
Is that because you think they, what happened to you is one of their biggest fears?
Yeah, and this didn't happen. Yeah. Back in 89, it happened, but it wasn't in the media.
Yeah.
Like, people didn't know how to deal with it. They had only just started a sex crime unit in the police force. Like, this was not something that people were used to.
And I guess with sexual assault and abuse and, you know, a stranger attack is like, you, they say it's not as common as, you know, familial abuse by people known to you. And so this is terrifying.
That's exactly right. This is not something that, and this guy could be living next door to them. Who knows?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, going back to school, I remember that I actually missed out on Red Nose Day because I didn't go to school for quite some time. I don't remember how long. But, yeah, I remember being devastated because I missed out on Red Nose Day. I also remember, how silly is this, I remember being so devastated that I couldn't get my school bag back because they took all the evidence. And it was the time that Batman Returns had come out and I had all of my Batman Return badges on my school bag.
Yeah.
And I was so devastated that I couldn't get it back. And I couldn't understand why I couldn't have it back.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until later on that they were like, it was like it's covered in fingerprint, you know, dust and whatever else. No, it's
Kids though, isn't it? Because an adult would think, I don't want anything back that's got anything of his on it.
Yeah.
But for kids, it's like your little possessions are so important to you.
Yeah. You do remember those special things, don't you?
Yeah, but then again, that sort of stopped for me, like that little, I lost my innocence that day.
Yeah,
no doubt.
He took it away. This is something that really is hard for me. But growing up, my nickname was Gin Mitty, always. So Mum would call me Gin. Even my sister now occasionally still calls me Gin. And the night of the attack when I went to bed, I had to sleep with the lights on.
Mm.
And Mum said, "Good night, Gin Mitty." And I turned to her and I said, "Gin Mitty doesn't live here anymore. Sorry."
No, I don't.
But that's one bit where I go, that's like that little girl saying, that little Gin Mitty's not here anymore. It's been taken away. I think that's the worst part of it.
Yeah.
All I want is like for my kids to be kids.
Mm.
I didn't even know what an erect penis was.
No. It must have been really
scary. In the statement it said that, his penis was standing up.
Mm.
And another thing was, which again is the innocence thing, is that I said that in my statement, I don't quite remember it, but in my statement I said that he weed all over me.
Yeah.
Now I know that it wasn't wee.
Yeah.
So now later on in life. But you know what? I'm so glad he did.
Yeah.
Because that's what caught him.
Okay. That evidence.
Yeah, that evidence was what caught him.
As the years went on, and I mean, you know, I know you lost your innocence, but you were still a little girl.
Yeah, at this stage. Right. Yeah.
As you started to sort of get that little bit older and to understand more of what had happened to you.
Yes.
What was life like then? I mean, as you started to get into sort of towards puberty and.
Yeah, well, I guess then it just wasn't really talked about that much anymore. I don't think there was really any counselling done afterwards because, again, I don't think there was much available. I don't actually remember any.
Really?
My sister said she vaguely remembers a woman coming over to our house once. Wow. So then it wasn't something that we weren't allowed to talk about, but it's not something that you just talk about while you're sitting around at the kitchen table when you're 11.
No.
It's, you know what I mean? It's just not something that's really brought up. So you always live with it, but you never really discuss it. And, yeah, I didn't have any counselling until it wasn't until I was 18 when I was diagnosed with depression and then started that. But I'm sure that obviously there was issues much further on. I didn't have a very good, you know, school life. I didn't enjoy school. I dropped out at the end of year 11, which I just about failed on attendance because I wagged every day. Mum had no idea.
Yeah. But when you started to sort of come into your sexual maturity, how was that affected?
Do you know what? It actually wasn't.
Okay.
Yep, it wasn't at all. Like when I was 17, 18 and all of that, I was going out night clubbing mm-hmm. and picking up boys. And
were you scared of sex?
No.
Wow, okay.
No.
Okay.
And I wasn't actually really for quite a few years in my late teens, so sort of, you know, 17, 18, 19, even early 20s, I wasn't scared of anything.
Yeah, okay.
Like I got to the stage where I was like, you know what? The worst thing has happened to me already.
Yeah, okay.
What else can you do?
Yeah.
So for me, the next worst thing would be death. At that time of my life. Yeah. So for me, I wasn't scared at all. Like I would go out walking the streets at, you know, 3 o'clock in the morning. There is no way in the world that I would do it now.
Did you go through the promiscuous phase that rape victims sometimes do? Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and there was no care. Like it didn't really mean much, really. I guess that's how it always was. Like, in my head that it, yeah, I don't know, like it's, you know, you think that like sex and, you know, intercourse is something that's supposed to be a loving thing between two people, but that was not what I knew it as, if that makes sense.
Well, yeah, in fact, that's what they say, isn't it, that oftentimes victims of sexual assault want to minimise it.
Yeah.
Want to take any kind of power out of it and significance out of it.
Definitely.
To minimise what happened to them.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Hence the promiscuity. Did it work? Did it make...
No.
No. Okay.
No, not really.
All these years are going by and what's happening with the investigation all this time?
Well, I assumed nothing.
Okay.
Obviously. Like I had no idea. I hadn't been contacted by anybody. So I was just going on, living my life, believing that he would never be caught.
Oh, boy, scared? Were you scared he's coming back? Were you?
Not so much. I don't know why. I guess, why would he come back now? Like, and I guess when I was older, why would he?
When you were little, were you scared he'd come back?
I think when I was little I was. I don't actually remember, like, lying in bed, but I know that I slept with the lights on for a long time. I was too scared to sleep in the dark. But no, I don't actually remember ever being scared of him. I remember that I was scared when he wasn't first caught, that I was scared that he was going to do it to somebody else.
Yeah.
And it was more so that's what I guess why I wanted him to be caught, was so he couldn't do it to somebody else, not so he couldn't come back, not, you know, he wouldn't be able to come back and get me. That wasn't actually a thought, which actually could have been quite possible. So, yeah, so I guess in 2014 it was, September 2014, that I contacted the police again. So I went, first of all, I went to our local, just my local police station where I live now. I spoke to the the constable that just was at the office, you know, at the desk, and he was really, really lovely, but I think he was a bit sort of like, oh, my gosh.
I guess. What a spin out.
Who are you?
Yeah.
Because I wanted to find information on it. I had no information on it.
Had your parents pursued it over the years?
No. Well, so I actually haven't spoken to my mum in 10 years. I haven't had any contact with her for other reasons. Yes. That's a whole other podcast.
Sure.
yes. But, so there's a few reasons why, I haven't spoken to her. And my dad actually passed away in November He was sick with Huntington's disease.
Oh, right.
And my father was a bit of an alcoholic too, so I don't think he had much memory of...
Was he...
It happened.
Always? Did he always have an alcohol?
Yes.
Okay, so before your attack.
Yeah, okay. So, and he and mum split up when I was 8. So
after
the attack. Yeah. Okay. So, and yeah, he's always been a big drinker.
Okay.
Always loved the drink more than anything, unfortunately. Great guy, but so I don't think that either of them had pursued anything. I don't think mum had over the years.
Okay.
So, yeah.
So you've walked in on this guy's shift. He's just doing the afternoon shift at the police station.
Pretty much. Okay. Pretty much, and said, Yeah, I want you to find something. Like, can you find something? And he's like, you know, looked on the computer and he's like, nothing. I'm like, it was 1989. Like, it won't be on the computer. I'm like, I don't know how you police keep your records, but I doubt very much somewhere. That it's, that chart. Like, I'm thinking cold case, you know, like where they walk down like this aisle and there's just boxes everywhere and they pull a box out, you know. So he, after a little bit of investigating, he actually found a document and I never saw the document. But it was one-page document and he was doing night shift and so he rang me this morning and said, I've got this document. You can come and pick it up tonight. I start work at 10 o'clock. I was like, oh, fantastic, great. So I was thinking, great, here's my first little bit of information on my case. And then he rang me at like 10 o'clock that night and he goes, oh, I'm really sorry, but the senior sergeant's just told me that I'm actually not allowed to give this to you and I'm not even allowed to show it to you, so I'm really sorry. You'll have to go through the correct process to get anything. And I was like, oh, damn. And so then I went, it was in the newspaper. Go to the State Library. So I went to the State Library and I brought up the Herald Sun, or the Sun back then, or the Herald, that it was in, and I found the newspaper articles, and it was, that was really, like, I went in by myself and just sat there on this computer, you know, with everybody else thinking, oh, what are they looking up? Yeah. And, you know, they're doing, you know, some work on their assignment or whatever, and here I am looking up, newspaper articles from when I was attacked. It just was a bit weird. Yeah, so I found them, and it was such a surprise because, like, I could remember in my head seeing the newspaper article. And it was exactly in the paper where I thought it was, like up in the top corner. And it was like, oh, my gosh. And the newspaper also had something about Red Nose Day on it. So once I got to it, I was like, oh, I'm onto something here. And so, yeah, there was three newspaper articles that I collected that day. And that's when I went, right, I'm going to start ringing around more. And so, as I said, I think I spoke to about six or seven different police officers until one took me seriously. And she was just the most beautiful lady. And she was like, okay, I can hear in your voice that. And I said, look, I've spoken to so many people. Everyone just keeps telling me to ring this department, that department. Nobody wants to help. Please, please, can you do something? She was like, all right, leave it with me. And then we started communicating via email. And it was a little bit later on in the year that she sent me an email back and she said, I just wanted to let you know that I've just had this, received this email from the biology department. And then was a copy and pasted email which said that we wanted to let you know that we have tested some of the evidence, but unfortunately this time we were unable to get any DNA off the evidence. And she just, you know, wrote at the bottom, look, I'm really, really sorry, but, you know, we had a look into it. You know, we'll continue to look on into it, but this is where it stands. And from that I just went, stuff it. I should never have opened this up. Why did I try? You know, here I am thinking that he's going to be caught and that email was just like my dead end. Yeah. Nothing's ever going to happen. So I just went on living life again.
And how were you living life? Like, you know, how was your mental health? How are your relationships?
So my mental health has always been a bit of a struggle, up and down, been on and off antidepressants. I spent 2 weeks in Monash Psychiatric Ward when I was in my early 20s for depression and wanting to end my life. I was then, like, with the CAT team for a long time. They used to come every morning and every night to give me my tablets because they actually wouldn't leave me with a day's worth of tablets because they were scared I would collect them and try and overdose. Okay. So, yeah, so they'd come morning and night to give me my tablets. Mm. And, yeah, and then, like, they put me on some, like, I was on antipsychotics and some pretty full-on drugged up medication.
So to take yourself into the police station and like to decide to pursue this and go through all the process, all the phone calls, find this lady who's supportive and then get this let down.
Yeah. And I never even emailed her back.
Yeah.
And I was like, and do you know what? I actually probably felt worse that I never emailed her back.
Because
I was like, she's gone and done all this work and here I am, I just went, oh, I'll bug you. I'm not emailing you back.
Yeah.
But I just couldn't. Yeah. I was like, what do I write? Oh, thanks, but no thanks. Yeah. Like, you know, like.
Yeah, you can't write back. Oh, that's okay.
Yeah,
it's
not. It's okay. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's not.
Yeah.
And it wasn't. And I was so angry.
Yeah.
I was angry that I had hope because you don't want to have hope, but it's so hard not to. So then, yeah, I just went on living, like just getting by. We've got a couple of kids, you know, so, and they're great. They're my life.
Mm.
They're why I'm here.
Yeah.
You know, is for my girls. Yeah, so just, yeah, you know, living life and going on. And then it was the Monday before Good Friday the following year, so in 2015. And I was having an afternoon nap because, you know, you sleep when your kids sleep.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I woke up and I had a missed call on my phone. It was a guy and he said, "Hi, Alicia, it's Lee Prados from the Cold Case of Missing Persons Unit, wondering if you could from Victoria Police. I was wondering if you could please call me back." And all I heard was Lee Prados, Victoria Police. And I went, "Oh, shit, what have I done?"
Oh, yeah, of course.
Why are the police ringing me? Because it was like five months afterwards.
Do
like
I have a speeding ticket?
Yeah.
Exactly. Or, have I done something in my car? Have I cut someone off? Oh, my God, you know, all these things. So I rang back straight away. Or what has my partner done?
Yeah.
That was my other thing. Oh, God, what's he done?
Is he okay?
You know, is
everyone okay?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I was more, what has he done? Sure. Isn't that bad? But, so I rang back straight away. And he goes, "I just wanted to let you know that Robin Waite, the detective from the CIU unit that you've been speaking with, actually passed your case on to me and I've been working on it since late last year." He goes, "I'm wondering if I could come out and see you." And I was like, oh,
wow.
What? Yeah, sure. And he goes, "What about I come out on Thursday?" And he goes, "Look, I'll bring Robin. Would that suit you if we come to your house?" And he goes, "Oh, we can do it at the police station." I was like, "Oh, no, just come to the house. No, that's fine." So sure enough, on the Thursday before the Good Friday in 2015, they turn up. Lee's very, very, he's younger than me. And then there was Robin and I just hugged her.
Yeah.
And said, "I'm so sorry, I never emailed you back."
Isn't it funny? So that's sorry. The thing you.
Yep, that was all I was worried about was, yeah, was
sure
saying
she
sorry.
You.
She was like, "Oh, don't be silly." Yeah. You know? And I was like, "All right, come in. Do you want a cup of tea?" Like, you know, I was really nervous. I don't have visitors coming over to my little.
Me neither. House, me know? Neither. So I get it totally. Yeah.
And I'm like, do I offer them tea or are they going to.
Do
like,
I have sugar?
Yeah. Like, is tea? That is that the dumb thing? Are they allowed? Like, it's not like I'm going to say, do you want a beer?
Tea
but, you know, yeah, that's right. Do I offer them busy? Yeah. They're like, no, we don't want anything. I'm like, oh, okay. And so, yeah, so they literally sat at both ends of the kitchen table and I was in the middle. And as I said, my youngest daughter was asleep in the cot in the next room and my daughter who. She must have been about four. She was in the lounge room watching Finding Nemo and we just sat and he just talked all. He's like, "I want to speak to you about the day, what you can remember." He asked me to read my statement.
Oh, this is that day?
Yep, so this is that day.
Wow.
So, yeah, so he asked me to read my statement.
Gosh, so you were really unprepared for that. That just all happened.
He didn't tell me why they were coming to see me.
Yeah.
He just said, "We want to come and see you to speak about your case." So I had no idea about anything. So then he goes on about how they pulled more evidence out of the freezer.
Mm.
He said there was more evidence that we found in the freezer. And he said, "We have pulled DNA off it." And as he started talking about that, my four-year-old's coming, "I need to go to the toilet."
Of course, oh, of course, yes.
At this time, all right, quick.
Yes.
Right, come and sit on the toilet. And as I've come, sat back down, like my four-year-old's sitting on the toilet, like I could almost see her.
Yeah.
And he goes, "I just wanted to let you know that we've got a match."
After the break, Alicia tells us more about the conviction of her attacker. Coming up on Australian True Crime, Alicia reveals more about the legal proceedings leading to her attacker's conviction.
And that's exactly what I did. I gasped
and
then wailed.
Yes, of course.
Like a baby.
Oh, my God. They had a match with a person already in their system.
Yep.
Was he already in their system as a perpetrator?
Yes.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
Literally was like, what? And then the next thing, it was like, "Mum," because I've got the little one, "come and wipe my bum."
You know? Of course.
Like, yes. And I literally just was sitting there wailing and it was just bang, gone.
Yes,
right.
Yes.
Over here. Right. You go back in there. And then I just sat there in shock.
Oh, my God.
Going, what? Oh like you know who it is. I'm like, who? He's like, "I can't tell you." He goes, "The only thing I can tell you is that we are keeping an eye on him." And so then I was like, oh, my God. So, like, they can't arrest him, but, like, they've got, like, someone following him. I was like, wow, how are they keeping an eye on him?
And he's obviously
like,
not.
This is crazy.
He's not in prison at the time.
Yeah. Well, he could have been because he said we're keeping an eye on him. Okay. That's all he said. And because I asked that, is he in jail? He's like, I cannot tell you anything.
Oh.
I asked like so many questions, and every time I go, can I just, like, I know you're going to say no, but did he? And he's like, I can't tell you.
I guess there's reasons for that, isn't there? So
he hadn't been arrested.
Yeah, and you don't go and do your own form of,
that's right.
Arrest or
that's
justice.
Right. And as he explained, as Lee explained to me, unfortunately in cold cases, so this is 27 years after the fact, so that DNA, so in 1989, DNA wasn't available in Australia. In like, say, like a quite vicious murder case or something like that, they may send it off to America for testing to be done, but it wasn't really openly available here. And then once it was only murder cases that, you know, they sort of followed up. And I can't remember his name, and one of the police officers that you've been speaking to in one of your podcasts mentions his name, but he put all the evidence into a freezer and thought, let's freeze all of this. We don't have DNA.
It was Keith Moore.
Keith Moore was, the journalist did the story. And he has actually also done a story on Sterling Bauer, my attacker as well, which I sent him an email to thank him for that. Because any time his name's mentioned in the media is like a massive bonus for me.
Okay.
Because what more of a sentence could you get than everybody in the world knowing that you're a rapist? That to me is more of a sentence than any jail time that he can do.
Yep.
Yeah, I want him to walk out of jail and be thinking that every person he walks past in the street knows what he did.
That he's a convicted rapist.
Yeah, that he is, that to me would be, the greatest sentence that he could ever have.
So how did he go from the person who can't be named at your kitchen table to convicted rapist Sterling Bauer?
So as the detective explained to me, it's not just a case of we've got his DNA, he did it. Because it's been stored in a freezer for 27 years, defence could come back and say that it was contaminated, blah, 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 blah. So they obviously need a lot more information to pinpoint him back to the area and to the crime. And there's so many ways that it was done, and there was things that we found out that just blew us away. So, you know, obviously we couldn't be told anything at the start, and it wasn't until the day that he was arrested that they told us his name. And it wasn't until he pleaded guilty that they actually told us he lived in the next street.
Oh!
So that corner that he picked me up on, he actually lived in the block of units on that corner. So that's how he knew me. That's how he'd seen me. He'd see me every day walk past his house.
How accurate now, looking back, was your sketch?
It was almost 100%. And that was one of the things that, and I've got goosebumps now because the detective said to me, he goes, I can't believe how well, as a 7-year-old, you got it right.
But I can't believe how this man was living in the community.
The next
with
street.
With posters up everywhere of his face. As drawn by you and the artist, and nobody...
How did nobody...
Yeah, he was 21 years old. It was actually 2 days before his 21st birthday. Yeah, so...
Did you ever see him after?
No. My sister swears that she knew who he was, and actually the teacher from our high school that we went to, his son was actually accused because he looked very similar to the sketch, but I knew him and I knew it wasn't him.
Right.
But this guy was 21, but as a 7-year-old, I said he was about 16 or 17 or between 16 and 18, which is not that far off.
No.
So, again, pretty good because I ask my 7-year-old, you know, how old someone is, and she'd look at someone who looked like me and say she's probably 80 or something.
Totally.
You know, like So he sort of fit the profile where he was actually a little bit older. So they thought he might have been a school-age kid. So when, like, straight after it happened, like, the police would come around with school photos and I would sit there all night looking at school photos to try and see if I could find him in there. So that was one of the things that the detective said to him when interviewing him was, this sketch is you. You can't deny that the similarities here. And he showed him a picture of him when he was 21 and said, here. Yeah.
How was the court case? Did he plead guilty? Did he
Not at the start. Okay, right. So here's something that's quite funny. Mm. So my sister lives up in Queensland, and when this first happened, she was the first witness, so she had to verify her statement. And I also had to go to the police station before he was arrested and redo my statement as well, and I added about 14 pages of things that I remembered that weren't in my statement originally. Mm. And they needed to do that with my sister. And so my sister and I were so excited going, oh, they're going to fly you down to Melbourne. Like, right, oh, my God, we're going to get to see each other, because we never get to see each other. So we were so excited. And because my sister and I were told we were not allowed to discuss it at all. And we didn't. Like, we were so good with that. Jeez, it was so hard. Because I want to be like, oh, no, we're not allowed to talk about it. And then, yeah, so we were so excited thinking, oh, she's coming down. And then the police told me, oh, we're actually going up to Queensland. And I was so shattered.
Yeah.
So I was like, oh, they're going up to you. I want to come too. Like, why can't you come down here?
Didn't even get to see each other.
Yeah. So they went and saw her on the Wednesday, and she had her appointment, you know, with them. They came and saw her at her work. And then when she was leaving, she was like, you know, where are you staying? And, oh, you've got to, she's on the Sunshine Coast. Oh, you've got to go to Caloundra. You've got to go to the beach here, and you should stop here. And she's giving them all directions. And there, you know, standing at Lee, and he had another detective with him. Oh, yeah, you know, we'll check that out. Well, anyway, Lee's rung me at 10 o'clock the next morning. And he goes, Alicia, I just wanted to let you know we've arrested him. I was like, what? He lived 30 minutes away from my sister up in Queensland. That's why they went to Queensland.
Oh,
not just to do her statement. They were going to arrest him. So here's my sister going, oh, you should be going here and you should be going there. And they're like, yeah, we don't care about the beach. Like, we're coming to arrest this man.
Oh.
So, yeah. So
they had to extradite him to Victoria.
So he was actually on parole. Up in Queensland. So that's how they were keeping an eye on him.
Can we say, was he on parole for a sexual assault?
Yes, another child. Yeah. And they had to go to court the next morning. So then they went to court on the Friday morning to get permission to extradite him to Melbourne. And that's what they did. He never applied for bail the whole time. But I was told, like, that to me, I found it really strange. Like, found really strange. Why wouldn't you apply for bail? He's saying to the police he didn't do it. So why, if you didn't do it, why sit in jail? But they explained to me that if he did get bail, he would then have like 24 hours to get back up to Queensland. Otherwise, he would be breaking his parole conditions. And it would have cost him money which he didn't have. He didn't have a cent to his name. Apparently.
I also wonder if the conditions of where he was being held were such that he would be happier to stay there. Comfortable because I wonder if he knew that he would be found guilty. And I see that he was sentenced to a minimum of 4 years with 1 year already served.
Yeah.
So if he was confident that the time he was serving before his case went to trial would count, then he might have thought, well, I might as well stay here where I'm comfortable, and that will count against the time that I end up serving.
Yeah, because by the time it gets to court, yeah.
Potentially. I mean, I don't know, these guys know this stuff.
Do you know what? You'd never be able to know what they were thinking because we're not like them.
No, exactly.
So
I mean, what of that sentence? It's sickening.
Yeah.
It's sickening that a person can rape at least two children and end up in jail for 4 years.
What I was actually told was in the sentencing that they can't actually take into effect anything that he has done after the crime. He has to be sentenced as if it was 1989.
Okay, I get that. But you know what? Like, rape one child and can you never come back, please?
Yeah.
Like, why should you ever come back?
That's right.
I don't understand how you can lead one child away and sexually assault them and ever come back.
Mm.
I don't understand.
I don't either.
Because that's not, you know, there's so much premeditation. There's so much planning gone into that.
There was. I mean, as I said, he knew. He knew what time I was going to be coming from school.
Yeah.
One of the other really, really interesting things as well is that the way that they caught him was, as I said, it wasn't just DNA. So they knew where he lived.
Mm.
Then they found out where he worked, and he worked for a removalist. And so the police went to the removalist, and the removalist actually had his diary from 1989.
Wow.
Which told them, the police, exactly what time Sterling Bauer worked on that Wednesday. So Bauer had said, it couldn't have been me because I was at work all day. Mm. But his boss actually said, no, they finished at midday on that day.
Oh, my God.
What sort of a boss keeps those sort of records?
That's like, I'm thinking of Teacher's Pet.
Yeah.
A very popular podcast where the concreter had the diaries of the jobs they did like 20 years before.
Yeah. Like he knew. He was like, no, this job was, it would have taken him this amount of time. Nah, he would have been knocked off by midday.
Amazed the books people keep. I reckon my dad's got a diary from 1989. You'd be amazed books people keep.
I know. Well, I've got just about every single birthday card I've ever been given.
Yeah, there you go. Now, you went to, he's extradited to Melbourne.
Yep.
You went to every appearance, didn't you?
Yeah. So the first one was the committal mention, which is pretty much just that. The police told me, look, it's going to be a five-minute thing, but I wanted to go because it was going to be my first time seeing him. And the police also explained that because it's a five-minute thing, it would be very unlikely that he would actually be there. They would just do a video cross to him in jail, which is what they did. And I thought that's probably a really good first way to see him. I'm not actually going to be face-to-face with him in the room. And, so the committal mention was it's like a five-minute thing, just telling the courts what is going to, you know, what he's been. They didn't even say what he'd been charged with because still to this day I don't know the full list of charges.
And how was it when you saw him on the screen?
It was hard.
Yeah.
The first minute was hard, and then I just wanted to glare at him. Like I wanted to show him, and I'm sure that if – because he could see the court too apparently. But I don't know whether he could see me or not. But I was sitting there thinking, I hope you can see me, and I hope that you can see I'm not taking my eyes off the TV screen because I just wanted to glare at him. And – and actually, it was more the second time. The second time I saw him, I actually walked away and I hate to say this out loud, but I almost felt a little bit sorry for him.
Mm.
I was like, you're actually really pathetic.
Mm.
He looked a little bit simple and his tracksuit was like a size too small so I could see like the bottom part of his belly. And I was, he just came across, and he's not. Yeah.
I mean, to be a sex offender, you know, I think there's generally a fair bit of cunning, rat cunning involved.
Yeah,
so I'm sure he's not simple. But
yeah, but I did. I was like, I don't want to feel sorry for you because I hate him. Like, I hate him.
Did you recognise him when you saw his face?
Yeah. It was him. So, but that was more actually looking at Facebook.
Yeah.
Because he had a Facebook profile.
Oh,
Facebook.
God, how was
that? Yeah, so as soon as I found out, as soon as he was arrested, that's when they told me his name.
So you're like on the...
So, oh, gosh,
of course. Human nature.
Oh,
human nature.
Who isn't?
Of course. I never thought of that.
Yeah, so I actually had, and he actually, on his Facebook profile, had photos of him from 1989.
Oh, geez.
Yeah.
That's bloody bold.
Yeah. So, and like I look at the photo and I go, that's like taken where we grew up because you can tell by the pine trees and the fence and, you know, that's a local photo.
Yeah. I know where you're meaning because I grew up around there.
Yeah.
So exactly what you're talking about.
Was quite interesting. So, yeah, so then the second one, the second court case, so all along he was still claiming he didn't do it. Wasn't me. One of the things that I sort of laugh at is your DNA's on my jumper.
Yeah.
And he said he didn't know us. He said he had no idea who we were. If he said he was like a friend of my brother's and maybe he'd been in our house or something, there might be a reason that DNA, but why is a man's semen on a seven-year-old's jumper? Like it can't be, you know, like, oh, a bit of, you know, a hair or something like that. Like this is obvious.
Yeah.
But he denied. And then the next case was the committal hearing, which I wasn't asked to go to, but I ummed and ahed about whether I would. It was a two-day thing and for most of it I wasn't actually allowed to be in the room for it, and that was on the Monday and the Tuesday. And then on the Friday I got the call to say that he had pled guilty to rape. So and prosecution accepted it.
Wow.
So they said,
so that was that.
We need to accept it.
Yeah.
So yeah, so he did that, as I said, on the Friday. I was in really mixed emotions because that was the lesser charge. The worst charge was penetration of a child under 10, and that's what I wanted him to go with, because that was the maximum penalty was 20 years, which I knew he would never get it. But the maximum penalty for rape was only 10 years. Mm. And rape is a very big umbrella.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, and not to say that anyone's case is worse than another, but I just feel that any crime against a child is just so unforgivable, and that's probably because I am one.
I don't think anyone's going to hold that against you,
but
that's okay.
Yeah, as yes. I think I said to you out in the foyer before I came in, like, this is my life.
Yeah.
I'm 36 years old. This is all I know.
Yeah.
I have no idea the type of person that I would be today had this not happened to me. And that's really unfair.
And it's so much more than the offence is horrific enough, but it's that broader impact.
Yeah.
What would have happened had this not happened to me? Would I have stayed at school?
Yeah. Would I be more successful in my career?
Would, would I parent differently? Would my mum have parented differently?
Oh, totally. And the ripple effect, even for my sister.
Yeah.
You know, my brother. Like, these are things that they've had to live with as well. My sister, you know, it's horrible what he's done.
He's taken away a lot.
Yeah, he's taken away a life that I never knew, that I have, no chance of ever knowing.
No.
Because that's it. That's my life.
So what happens?
So he
goes to jail?
Yeah, so he pled guilty. Jeez, the court process is a long time. Like, I thought, okay, he's arrested. This is it. So this is 2015. He was arrested. I'm thinking, oh, by Christmas, all this is done and dusted. It's gone.
Mm.
But no. He was in jail for nearly a year before it even got to the county court. So the plea hearing, so he pled guilty, and then it was sent over to the county court, and then it was April the following year that we went there. So the first was a plea hearing there where he pled guilty. I got to do my victim impact statement. My sister did hers. My mother also did one as well. So she was there.
How was that? Seeing your mum?
Yeah, it was a bit weird. Yeah. We didn't talk. I had said to the police that and the prosecution's, who are they, like their counsellor people, I had said, you know, I don't, today at times, now's not the time for us to be, you know, back then it was 8 years that we hadn't been speaking. I'm like, now's not the time to be, you know, bringing that up. So they just kept us separate.
Mm.
One of the really, like, bizarre things is Senior Sergeant Paul McBride, who has just retired from the Ringwood Police
Station. I know his name from when I was a reporter.
Ah, well, there you go. Well, he came. He actually worked on the case back in 1989 and he was still serving the police force. So he came along, which was so awesome.
I bet it was incredibly satisfying for him.
See it through.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. This is my thing. Like, it must be, for the police, for my mum. Like, I never would have stopped my mum coming because she would have wanted to see this day for a long time too.
I don't know what happened between you and your mum 10 years ago, but she is still the lady who got in her car and drove around the neighbourhood.
But yeah, I couldn't even imagine.
No.
I couldn't.
So you've got compassion for your mum.
Oh, definitely. It'd be horrible.
Yeah.
Like, so horrible to live through. So horrible. So, so she had a right to be there. I would never have said, and I could have said, I don't want to be in the same room as her or whatever, but no, I wasn't going to be that petty. I wasn't going to sit next to her. But, she was, more than welcome to come in.
Yeah.
So I stood up and did my victim impact statement, which I'm so disappointed about. God, I wish I could go back and do
Why?
It again. Because I was so worried that they weren't, whatever I wrote in it, they weren't going to allow it.
Who's the boss of victim impact statements?
You actually do get, and I think I've brought it with me today, you actually do get a guideline of what you can and can't put in there. I was really worried that there were going to be things that I wasn't, because you weren't allowed to say things like, I think you should go to jail for the rest of your life. I was so funny about what I could and couldn't say that I then look back now and go, oh, that was really, like, I wanted to say to him, I fucking hate you. You've stuffed up my fucking life. And the worst thing was he was behind us.
Oh, so you couldn't even eyeball him to say it.
No. So I'm standing looking at the judge And here I am, like, I was so proud of myself because, it's, you know, before I was like, I don't know if I'm going to be able to get up and read it. Mm. Like, I'm, like, generally I'm a massive blubbering mess. Like, I've high-fived me for today.
Yeah,
you're amazing.
Like, normally I'm quite proud that I haven't cried that much. But yeah. I was thinking, oh, my God, I don't think I'm going to be able to do it. And then I was like, yep, I'm doing this. And he was behind me.
That's crazy.
And so then when I finished and walked back to where I was sitting, I eyeballed him, and the whole time he had his head down. And I wanted to say to him, lift up your head and look me in the eye.
Yeah.
Like, I want you to look at me.
Yeah.
I want you to, yeah.
Well, no, because he's a coward. He only takes on children.
Well, that's right. So, yeah. So, as I said, that was pretty disappointing, not seeing him and him having his head down. But then I was like, oh, well, at least he's so ashamed that he can't even look at me, so he should.
What have you been able to do with this horrific experience? Like, how do you make it, you own it in a way where you can help others?
Well, I don't know. Like, I just, I don't feel like I have helped any others yet. I want to.
Because, like, what changes, if anything, when you've spent your entire life with this perpetrator out there and this unsolved case, and then it's solved, like,
and that's how it was,
right? Yes,
it, so it literally went to doing my victim impact statement. Then a week later, we had court again, which was sentencing, which was where he was sentenced to 6 years with 4 non-parole, and he was put on the sex offender register for 15 years once he's released.
Wouldn't it be for life?
That's what I don't understand.
Because it's going to magically stop being a sex offender.
Yeah, that's right.
And the judge actually said that he believed that his chances of rehabilitation were cloudy. So if his chances of rehabilitation are cloudy, why wouldn't you put him on the sex offender register for life? He's 50.
Now?
Now.
Yeah.
So when he comes out of jail, he's 51. When he gets off the sex offender register, he's still in his 60s. Like, look at how many 60-year-olds are fit and healthy and running around and could easily attack a child.
Yeah.
Like, that to me is, like, I cannot understand. And so that's where I said, like, the newspaper articles where they had a picture of his face and his name, that is brilliant.
Yeah, okay.
That's on the internet forever.
Yeah.
He's got his name. It's not Bob Smith.
No.
You Google his name and only one person comes up.
Yeah.
So that, to me, is a greater sentence than anything that judge ever could have handed down, because it was never ever – do you know what? He could have given him life and it probably wouldn't have been enough.
We know from many, many, many people have said to us, closure doesn't exist, that's not a real thing.
No.
You never get anything back.
Do you know what? A relative actually said to me only a few weeks ago, oh, so are you over it now?
Yeah, right.
Wow. And you're like, oh.
Yeah.
And – Like, I laugh about it because it's crazy. Funny.
And they probably didn't mean it meanly, did they? They were like, just like, oh.
That's right. And I was like, no. Like, something I think about every single day of my life.
Yeah.
And even more so now when you hear about all these things in the news.
Mm.
I had a mum of, I won't go into too much detail, and it was someone in their family and it had been going on for a while.
No.
And, I haven't spoken to this person for ages, and I messaged them straight away and was like, oh, my gosh, I'm heartbroken. And then I couldn't sleep.
No.
Because, like, this is actually a friend. Like, this is not somebody on the news. This is not somebody, you know, in the newspaper. This is not someone you hear about. I actually know her, and I've met the daughter before, and she's 7 and I was 7 and I've got a 7-year-old. And it's really hit really close to home.
Mm.
And that's where it's then made me want to do this. And this is what the mum actually put in the post. She said, I've ummed and ahed about putting this post up. She goes, but people need to talk about it.
Mm.
And that's exactly right. And there's been some other people that I've mentioned to that I'm doing this podcast. And they're like, shouldn't you just, you know, let it lie?
Go quietly.
What are you rehashing things for? But I'm actually not rehashing things.
Mm.
Nothing gets rehashed. This is my life. Like, I live with it every day.
Yeah.
So it's not rehashing anything.
No.
And that's where, like, I want people to understand that is that, yeah, it's not something that you ever get over. You just learn to live with it.
Why should you have to put a lid on it and keep the pressure of this inside your own mind and your own body.
I didn't do anything wrong.
No, and you know what? For some people, they want to keep it private, and that's fine.
But if that's not you,
then please don't ever feel like you shouldn't tell your story.
And this for me was, as I said to you before, like I really feel like I messed up my victim impact statement.
Mm.
If I could go back and do it again or send him a letter, I so would, because I would redo it again. And my doctor, who I see regularly, I see him every fortnight, he actually said to me, he goes, you can do it. Like, just write it.
Yeah.
And I'm like, yeah, no, I can, but it's not the same.
Yeah.
So, and I didn't get a trial.
Mm-hmm.
So, which I know everybody says is a good thing, but it meant that I didn't get to have my say. So today was, that's what I'm taking away from this, is today was my chance to have my little say.
We've found so like many people, victims or family members of victims, say, I want to, for whatever their reasoning, they want their chance to tell their story.
Yep.
Yeah. We spoke a lot, didn't we, on email? Are you going to be ready for people messaging us?
Yeah.
Because it's going to happen, wanting to possibly get in contact with you. Are you going to be ready? Are you going to be all right with that?
100%. This is what I almost want to do. Like, I feel like I've gone something. When I say it, like I go, oh, God, you sound like such a knob.
Yeah.
But I feel like I've been through something that could actually help somebody else.
Yeah.
So, but I don't know what to do.
Yeah.
And, like, I'm a bookkeeper.
You say that like it's a bad thing.
That's a good thing.
What's wrong with that?
I love numbers.
Don't be smart to be a bookkeeper.
I can't be a bookkeeper.
Numbers are very certain, aren't they? They're very, you can't go wrong.
That's very much my personality. Yeah. Like I have quite a few OCD traits. Like I'm very much a perfectionist with a lot of things in my life, the house, you know, mess, things like that.
Yeah.
But I don't get anything out of it. And I want to do a bit more and, and I'm so, I know I get a bit teary, but I'm so okay with what's happened to me, which sounds really, but as I said to you, this is like, this is me. So if I wasn't okay with what had happened to me, like I'm not then okay with myself.
Yeah. No, I've met some of the guys from Ballarat that I was telling you about. There's a couple of those guys who I genuinely believe when they say, I'm okay.
Yeah.
Like they've been through a lot of counselling and they have taken sort of leadership roles within that community because they genuinely feel like they're okay.
Yeah.
And I have
no issues. Yeah. Like Emily, you asked me in the email, like, is there anything that you don't want us to ask you? And I'm like, no, like I am an open book.
Yeah.
I am, if anybody because wants to ask me.
Because why should you be ashamed?
That's right. That's true. I did nothing wrong.
No, you didn't.
And I guess I was concerned. I was like thinking.
Yeah, of course.
Are you going to be okay? Yeah, is this going to just be, I don't know, what's going to happen when you go home tonight? Like, are you going to be.
I can tell you now, I'll be having a couple of drinks.
Same.
But,
that's fine.
But you know what? Like, I'm actually going to be celebrating that. Yeah. Oh, I can't believe it's incredible. I just did this.
Like, and it's about owning your story, isn't it? It's if you can control your story. Other people can't control it for you, I guess.
And this is where, like, people don't talk about it because they're ashamed.
That's right.
And this is where I'm saying, like, I did nothing wrong.
Yeah, that's right.
Any victim, you know, whether somebody says their skirt was too short, their top was too tight, they shouldn't have been walking at night, all of that. You know, I have those thoughts too, but do you know what? Stuff everybody else, like, you didn't ask for this to be happen. I didn't ask for this to happen.
No.
So why should I be ashamed of it? He's the one that should be ashamed.
Mm.
He's the one that should be embarrassed, not me.
I think you've done a lot to help people in coming on the show. I think that, you know, you will find people will contact you and say that you've given them the confidence to seek help. People who have not disclosed sexual assault will feel like they can and if seek help to do that.
If one person did, then this has been worth it.
Yeah.
Like it, you know, that's...
Yeah.
Yeah, that's why I'm not keeping a lid on it.
And let's not forget, you took a rapist off the street for at least a couple of years, babe. Yeah.
And it's on his record now. And he'll be checked for
15 years.
Yes, pretty closely. Right. So thank you for that.
Thank you for downloading Australian True Crime, and thank you to our team, which is one person, Bartholomew Heeran. If you enjoy the podcast, please take the time to leave us a nice review and 5 stars and to follow us on Facebook.